Chapter 5. Living with the climate in Santa Teresa is rather like functioning in a room with an overhead light fixture. The illumination is uniform, clear and bright enough, but the shadows are gone and there is a disturbing lack of dimension. The days are blanketed with sunlight. Often it is 67 degrees and fair. The nights are consistently cool. Seasonally, it does rain, but the rest of the time one day looks very much like the next, and the constant cloudless blue sky has a peculiar disorienting effect, making it impossible to remember where one is in the year. Being in a building with no exterior windows gives the same impression, a subliminal suffocation, as though some but not all of the oxygen has been removed from the air. I left my apartment at 9 o'clock, heading north on Chapel. I stopped for gasoline, using the self-service pump, and thinking, as I always do, what a simple but absurd pleasure it is to be able to do that sort of thing myself. By the time I found K9 Corners, it was 9:15. The discreet sign in the window indicated that the place opened for business at 8. The grooming establishment was attached to a veterinarian's office on State Street, just where it made the big bend. The building was painted flamingo pink, one wing of it housing a wilderness supply store with a mummy bag hanging in the window and a dummy in a camping outfit staring blankly at a tent pole. I pushed my way into K9 Corners to the accompaniment of many barking dogs. Dogs and I do not get along. They inevitably stick their snouts right in my crotch, sometimes clamping themselves around my leg as though to do some kind of two-legged dance. On certain occasions I have limped gamely along, dog affixed, their masters swatting at them ineffectually, saying, "Hamlet, get down. What's the matter with you?" It is hard to look such a dog in the face, and I prefer to keep my distance from the lot of them. There was a glass showcase full of dog care products, and many photographs of dogs and cats affixed to the wall. To my right was a half-door, the upper portion opening into a small office with several grooming rooms adjoining. By peering around the door jamb, I could spot several dogs in various stages of being done up. Most were shivering, their eyes rolling piteously. One was having a little red bow put in its topknot right between its ears. On a work table there were some little brown lumps I thought I could recognize. The groomer, a woman, looked up at me. "Can I help you?" "The dog just stepped on that brown lump," I said. She looked down at the table. "Oh, Dashiell, not again. Excuse me a minute," she said. Dashiell remained on the table, trembling, while she grabbed for some paper towels, deftly scooping up Dashiell's little accident. She seemed pretty good-natured about it. She was in her mid-40s, with large brown eyes and shoulder-length gray hair, which was pulled back and secured with a scarf. She wore a dark wine-colored smock, and I could see that she was tall and slim. "Are you Gwen?" She glanced up with a quick smile. "Yes, that's right. I'm Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator." Gwen laughed. "Oh, Lord, what's this all about?" She disposed of the paper towel and moved over to the half-door and opened it. "Come on in. I'll be right back." She lifted Dashiell from the table and carried him into a back room just off to the left. More dogs began to bark, and I could hear a blower being turned off. The air in the place was dense with heat, scented with the smell of damp hair and the odd combination of flea syrup and dog perfume. The brown linoleum tile floor was covered with assorted clippings, like a barber shop. In the adjoining room I could see a dog being bathed by a young girl who worked over an elevated bathtub. To my left, several dogs, beribboned, were waiting in cages to be picked up. Another young woman was clipping a poodle on a second grooming table. She glanced at me with interest. Gwen returned with a little gray dog under her arm. "This is Waffles," she said, half clamping the dog's mouth shut. Waffles gave her a few licks in the mouth. She pulled her head back, laughing, and made a face. "I hope you don't mind if I finish this up. Have a seat," she said affably, indicating a metal stool nearby. I perched, wishing I didn't have to mention Lawrence Fife's name. From what Charlie Scorsone had told me, it would rather spoil her good humor. Gwen began to clip Waffle's toenails, tucking the dog against her body to prevent sudden moves. "You're local, I assume?" she said. "Yes. I have an office downtown here," I said, pulling out my ID automatically. I held it toward her so she could read it. She gave it a glance, apparently accepting it without much suspicion or concern. It always amazes me when people take me on faith. "I understand you used to be married to Lawrence Fife," I ventured. "Yes, that's right. Is this about him? He's been dead for years." "I know. His case is being opened up again." "Oh, that's interesting. By whom?" "Nikki, who else?" I said. "The homicide department knows I'm looking into it, and I have their cooperation, if that helps you any. Could you answer some questions for me?" "All right," she said. Her tone was cautious, but there was also a note of interest, as though she considered it a curious inquiry, but not necessarily bad. "You don't sound that surprised," I said. "Actually, I am. I thought that was finished business." "Well, I'm just starting to look into it, and I may come up with a blank. We don't have to talk here if it's inconvenient. I don't like to interrupt your work." "This is fine with me, as long as you don't mind watching me clip a few dogs. I really can't afford a timeout right now. We're loaded today." "Hold on," she said. "Kathy, would you hand me that flea spray? I think we missed a few here." The dark-haired groomer left the poodle long enough to reach up for the flea spray, which he passed over to Gwen. "That's Kathy, as you might have gathered," Gwen said. "The one up to her elbows in soap suds is Jan." Gwen began to spray Waffles, turning her face away to avoid the fumes. "Sorry. Go ahead." "How long were you married to Fife?" 13 years. We met in college, his third year, my first. I'd known him about 6 months, I guess." "Good years? Bad years?" "Well, I'm mellowing some on that," she said. "I used to think it was all a big waste, but now I don't know. Did you know Lawrence yourself?" "I met him a couple of times," I said, "just superficially." Gwen's look was wry. "He could be very charming if he wanted to, but at heart he was a real son of a bitch." Kathy glanced over at Gwen and smiled. Gwen laughed. "These two have heard my version about 100 times, she said by way of explanation. "Neither has ever been married, so I tend to play devil's advocate. Anyway, in those days I was the dutiful wife, and I mean I played the part with a dedication few could match. I cooked elegant meals, I made lists, I cleaned the house, I raised the kids. I'm not saying I'm anything unique for that, except that I took it awfully to heart. I wore my hair up in this French roll, not a pin out of place, and I had these outfits to put on and take off, kind of like a Barbie doll." She stopped and laughed at the image of herself, pretending to pull a string from her neck. "Hello, I'm Gwen, I'm a good wife," she burbled in a kind of nasal parrot tone. Her manner was rather affectionate, as though she, instead of Lawrence, had died, but was remembered fondly by dear friends. Part of the time she was looking at me, and part of the time she combed and clipped the dog on the table in front of her. But in any event, her manner was friendly. Hardly the bitter, withdrawn account I'd expected. "When it was over, I was pretty angry. Not so much at him as at myself for buying into the whole gig. I mean, don't get me wrong, I liked it at the time, and it suited me fine, but there was also a form of sensory deprivation going on, so that when the marriage blew up, I was totally unequipped to deal with the real world. He managed the money, he pulled the strings, he made the major decisions, especially where the kids were concerned. I bathed and dressed and fed them, and he shaped their lives. I didn't realize it at the time because I was just running around anxious to please him, which was no easy task. But now that I look back on it, it was really fucked." She glanced up at me to see if I'd react to the language, but I just smiled back. "So now I sound like all the other women who came out of marriages in that era. You know, we're all faintly grumpy about it because we think we've been had." "You said you'd mellowed some," I said. "How did that come about?" $6,000 worth of therapy," she said flatly. I smiled. "What made the marriage blow?" Her cheeks tinted slightly at that, but her gaze remained just as frank. "I'd rather save that for later if you're really interested." "Sure, fine," I said. "I didn't mean to interrupt anyway." "Well, it wasn't all his fault," she said. "But it wasn't all mine either, and he hosed me with that divorce. I'm telling you, I got beat up."
"How?"
"How many ways are there? I was scared, and I was also naive. I wanted Lawrence out of my life, and I didn't care much what it cost. Except the kids. I fought him tooth and nail over them, but what can I tell you? I lost. I've never quite recovered from that." I wanted to ask her about the grounds for the custody battle, but I had the feeling it was touchy stuff. Better to let that slide for the moment and come back to it later if I could. "The kids must have come back to you after he died, though, especially with his second wife going to prison." Gwen pushed at a strand of gray hair with a capable-looking hand. "They were almost college age by then. In fact, Gregory had left that fall, and Diane left the year after. But they were very messed-up kids. Lawrence was a strict disciplinarian. Not that I have any quarrel with that. I think kids need structure. But he was a very controlling person, really out of touch with anything emotional. Rather aggressive in his manner of dealing with anyone, the kids in particular. So the two of them, after 5 years of that regime, were both withdrawn and shut down, defensive, uncommunicative. From what I could tell, his relation to them was based on attack, being held accountable, much like what he had done with me. Of course, I'd been seeing them alternate weekends and that sort of thing, and I had the usual summer visitation. I just didn't have any idea how far it had gone. And his death was a kick in the head to them on top of that. I'm sure they both had a lot of feelings that were never resolved. Diane went straight into therapy, and Gregory's seen someone since, though not regularly." She paused a moment. "I feel like I'm giving you case histories here." "Oh, no, I appreciate your candor," I said. "Are the kids here in town, too?" "Greg's living south of Palm Springs, Salton Sea. He has a boat down there."
"What sort of work does he do?"
"Well, he doesn't have to do anything. Lawrence did provide for them financially. I don't know if you've checked on the insurance yet, but his estate was divided equally between the three kids, Greg, Diane, and Nikki's son, Colin."
"What about Diane? Where is she?"
"She's in Claremont, going to school, working on another degree. She's interested in teaching deaf children, and she seems to do very well. It worried me some at first, because I suspect in her mind it was all tied up. My divorce, Nikki, Colin, and her responsibility. Even though it had nothing to do with her."
"Wait a minute. I don't understand what you mean," I said.
Gwen glanced up at me with surprise.
"I thought you'd already talked to Nikki."
"Well, I talked to her once," I said.
"Didn't she tell you Colin was deaf?"
"He was deaf from birth. I don't really remember what caused it, but there was nothing they could do about it, apparently. Diane was very upset. She was 13, I think, when the baby was born, and maybe she resented the intrusion. I don't mean to be so analytical at every turn, but some of this came out with her psychiatrist, and it seems pertinent. I think now she can articulate most of it herself. In fact, she does. So I don't think I'm violating any confidence." She selected a couple of strands of ribbon from about 20 spools hung on pegboard on the wall above the grooming table. She laid a blue and an orange on Waffle's head.
"What do you think, Wuff? Blue or orange?"
Waffles raised her, I assumed, eyes and panted happily, and Gwen chose the orange, which I must admit made a certain jaunty sense against Waffles' silver-gray mop of hair. The dog was docile, full of trust, loving every move, even though half of Gwen's attention was turned to me.
"Gregory was into drugs for a while," Gwen said conversationally. "That's what his generation seemed to do while mine was playing house. But he's a good kid, and I think he's okay now, or as okay as he'll ever be. He's happy, which is a lot more than most of us can say. I mean, I'm happy, but I know a lot of people who aren't."
"Won't he get tired of boating?"
"I hope so," Gwen said lightly. "He can afford to do anything he wants, so if the leisure begins to pall, he'll find something useful to do. He's very smart, and he's a very capable kid in spite of the fact that he's idle right now. Sometimes I envy him that."
"Do you think it would distress the kids if I talked to them?"
Gwen was startled at that, the first time she'd seemed disconcerted by anything. "About their father?" "I may have to at some point," I said. "I wouldn't like to do it without your knowledge, but it might really help." "I suppose it would be all right," she said, but her tone was full of misgivings. "We can talk about it later. It may not be necessary at all." "Oh, well, I don't see how it could hurt. I must say I don't really understand why you're into this business again."
"To see if justice was done, I guess," I said. "It sounds melodramatic, but that's what it amounts to."
"Justice to whom? Lawrence or Nikki?"
"Maybe you should tell me what you think. I'm assuming there was no love lost between you and them. But do you think he got his just desserts?"
"Sure, why not?"
"I don't know about her.
I figure she had a fair trial, and if that's the way it came out, well, she must have done it. But there were times I'd have done it myself if I had thought of some way."
"So if she killed him, you wouldn't blame her?"
"Me and half a dozen others. Lawrence alienated a lot of people," she said carelessly. "We could have formed a club and sent out a monthly newsletter. I still run into people who sidle up to me and say, 'Thank God he's dead.' Literally, out of the corner of their mouths."
Gwen laughed again.
"I'm sorry if that sounds irreverent, but he was not a nice man."
"But who in particular?"
She put her hand on her hip and gave me a jaded look.
"If you got an hour, I'll give you a list," she said.
I laughed then. Her humor seemed irrepressible, or maybe she was only feeling ill at ease. Talking to a private eye is often unnerving to people. Gwen put Waffles in an empty cage and then went into the other room and let out a big English sheepdog. She lifted its front feet first, placing them on the table, and then she heaved its hind legs up while the dog whined uneasily.
"Oh, come on, Duke," she snapped. "This one is such a sissy."
"Do you think we could talk again soon?" I asked.
"Sure, I'd like that. I close up here at 6. If you're free then, we can have a drink. By the end of the day, I'm ready for one."
"Me too. I'll see you then," I said.
I hopped down off my stool and let myself out. When the door closed, she was already chatting with the dog.
I wondered what else she knew, and how much of it she was willing to share.
I also hoped to hell I could look that good in another 10 years.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
Chapter 6. I stopped off at a payphone and gave Nikki a call. She picked up on the third ring.
"Nikki, this is Kinsey. I have a request. Is there any way I can get into the house where you and Lawrence lived?"
"Sure. I still own it. I'm just leaving to drive up to Monterey to bring Colin back, but it's en route. I can meet you there if you like."
She gave me the address and said she'd be there in 15 minutes or so. I hung up and headed for my car. I wasn't sure what I was after, but I wanted to walk through the place, to get a feel for what it was like, living as they lived.
The house was in Montebello, a section of town where there are rumored to be more millionaires per square mile than in any other part of the country. Most of the houses were not even visible from the road. Occasionally you can catch a glimpse of a tiled roof hidden away in tangles of olive trees and live oak. Many parcels of land are bordered by winding walls of hand-hewn stone, overgrown with wild roses and nasturtiums. Towering eucalyptus trees line the roads, with intermittent palms looking like Spanish exclamation points. The Fife's house was on the corner of two lanes, shielded from view by 10-foot hedges that parted at one point to admit a narrow brick driveway. The house was substantial. 2 stories of putty-colored stucco with white trim. The facade was plain, and there was a portico to one side. The surrounding land was equally plain, except for patches of California poppies in shades of peach and rich yellow, gold, and pink. Beyond the house I could see a double garage with what I guessed was a caretaker's quarters above. The lawns were well tended, and the house, while it had an unoccupied look, didn't seem neglected. I parked my car on the portion of the drive that circled back on itself to permit easy exit. In spite of the red-tiled roof, the house looked more French than Spanish. Windows without cornices, the front door flush with the drive. I got out of my car and walked around to the right, my footsteps making no sound on the pale rosy bricks. In the rear I could see the outline of a swimming pool, and for the first time I felt something chill and out of place. The pool had been filled to the brim with dirt and trash. An aluminum lawn chair was half sunk in the sod, weeds growing through the rungs. The diving board extended now over an irregular surface of grass clippings and dead leaves, as though the water had thickened and congealed. A set of steps with handholds disappeared into the depths, and the surrounding concrete apron was riddled with dark splotches. I found myself approaching with uneasiness, and I was startled out of my concentration by the sound of malicious hissing. Waddling toward me with remarkable speed were two huge white geese, their heads thrust forward, mouths open like snakes with their tongues protruding, emitting a terrifying sound. I gave a low involuntary cry and began to backtrack toward my car, afraid to take my eyes off them. They covered the ground between us at a pace that forced me into a run. I barely reached my car before they caught up with me. I wrenched the door open and slammed it again with a panic I hadn't felt in years. I locked both doors, half expecting the viperous birds to batter at my windows until they gave way. For a moment they balanced, half-lifted, wings flapping, black eyes bright with ill will, their hissing faces even with mine. And then they lost interest and waddled off, honking and hissing, pecking savagely at the grass. Until that moment it had never even occurred to me to include crazed geese among my fears. But they had suddenly shot straight to the top of the list, along with worms and water bugs. Nikki's car pulled in behind mine. She got out with perfect composure and approached as I rolled my window down. The two geese appeared again around the corner of the house, making their flat-footed beeline for the flesh of her calves. She gave them an idle glance and then laughed. Both raised up again, short wings flopping ineffectually, their manner suddenly benign. Nikki had a bread bag in her hand, and she tossed them some crumbs. "What the hell are those things?" I eased out of the car cautiously, but neither paid the slightest attention to me. "That's Hansel and Gretel," she said amicably. "They're Emden geese." The geese part I could tell. What happened? Did somebody train them to kill? "It keeps little kids off the property," she said. "Come on in." She inserted a key in the lock, and the front door swung open. Nikki stooped to pick up some junk mail that had been pushed through the slot. "The mailman gives them saltines," she said as an afterthought. "They'll eat anything." "Who else had keys to this place?" I asked. I noticed an alarm system panel, which was apparently turned off. She shrugged. "Lawrence and me, Greg and Diane. I can't think of anyone else." "Gardner? Maid?" "Both have keys now, but I don't think they did at the time. We did have a housekeeper, Mrs. Voss. She probably had one."
"Did you have a security system then?"
"We do now, but that's only been in the last 4 years. I should have sold the place years ago, but I didn't want to make decisions like that when I was in prison."
"It must be worth a lot."
"Oh, sure. Real estate values have tripled, and we paid $750,000 at the time. He picked it out, put it in my name for business reasons, but it never did appeal to me much."
"Who did the decorating?" I asked.
Nikki smiled sheepishly. "I did. I don't think Lawrence knew any better, but I took a subtle revenge. He insisted that we buy the place, so I left all the color out."
The rooms were large, ceilings high, and plenty of light came in. The floors were dark-stained tongue and groove. The layout was very conventional. Living room to the right, dining room to the left, with the kitchen behind. There was a sitting room beyond the living room, and a long glassed-in porch along that side, running the length of the house. There was a curious air to the house, which I assumed was because no one had lived there for years, like a department store display of especially elegant appointments. The furniture was still in place, and there was no sign of dust. There were no plants and no magazines, no evidence of ongoing activity.
Even the silence had a hollow tone, barren and lifeless. The whole interior was done in neutral tones, grays and oyster whites, hazel and cinnamon. The couches and chairs were soft upholstered pieces with rounded arms and thick cushions, a sort of Art Deco look without any attempt at flash. There was a nice blend of modern and antique, and it was clear that Nikki knew what she was doing, even when she didn't care. Upstairs there were 5 bedrooms, all with fireplaces, all with bathrooms of remarkable size, deep closets, dressing rooms, the whole of it carpeted in thick fawn-colored wall-to-wall wool shag. "This is the master suite?" Nikki nodded. I followed her into the bathroom. Fat chocolate towels were stacked near the sink. There was a sunken tub, the surrounding ceramic tile, a pale tobacco shade. There was a separate glassed-in shower that had been outfitted as a steam room. Soap, toilet paper, Kleenex. "Do you stay here?" I asked as we came down the stairs. "I haven't as yet, but I may. I have someone come in every 2 weeks to clean, and of course there's a gardener on the premises all the time. I've been staying at the beach."
"You have another house out there?"
"Yes. Lawrence's mother left it to me."
"Why you and not him?"
She smiled slightly. "Lawrence and his mother didn't get along. Would you like some tea?"
"I thought you had to hit the road."
"I have time."
I followed her out to the kitchen. There was a cooking island in the center of the room, with a big copper hood above the burners, a wide expanse of chopping block counter, and all manner of pans, baskets, and kitchen implements hanging on a circular metal rack that extended from the ceiling. All of the other counters were white ceramic tile. A double stainless steel sink was sunk into one. There was a regular oven, a convection oven, a microwave, a refrigerator, 2 freezers, and impressive storage space. Nikki put some water on to boil and perched herself on a wooden stool. I took up a stool across from her, the two of us sitting in the center of the room, which looked as much like a chem lab as a cook's dream.
"Who have you talked to so far?" she asked.
I told her about my conversation with Charlie Scorsone. "They seem like an odd pair of friends to me," I said. "My recollection of Lawrence is a little hazy, but he always struck me as very elegant and cerebral. Scorsone's very physical. He reminds me of a guy in an ad for chainsaws."
"Oh, Charlie's a real scrapper. From what I hear, he came up the hard way, bulldozing his way past all obstacles. Kind of like the blurb on a paperback, stepping over the bodies of those he loved. Maybe Lawrence liked that. He always talked about Charlie with grudging respect. Lawrence had everything handed to him. Of course, Charlie thought Lawrence could do no wrong."
"That seemed clear enough," I said. "I don't suppose he had any motive for murder. Did you ever think he might have had a hand in it?"
Nikki smiled, getting up to take out cups, saucers, and tea bags. "At one time or another, I've considered everyone. But Charlie seems unlikely to me. He certainly didn't benefit financially or professionally."
She poured boiling water into both cups. "As far as the eye can see," I said, dunking my tea bag.
"Well, yes, that's true. I suppose there might have been some kind of hidden dividend, but surely that would have come to light at some point in the last 8 years."
"One would think."
I went on to tell her about my interview with Gwen. Nikki's cheeks went ever so faintly pink. "I feel bad about her," she said. "By the time they divorced, Lawrence really hated her, and I tended to fan the flames a bit. He never could take any responsibility for the failure of that marriage, and as a result he had to blame her and punish her. I didn't help. At first I really believed what he was saying about her. I mean, I personally thought she seemed like a capable person, and I knew Lawrence had been very dependent on her, but it was safer to wean him away by feeding his bad feelings. You know what I mean? In some ways, his hating her so strongly was no different from his loving her, but it made me feel more secure to widen the breach. I'm ashamed of that now. When I fell out of love with him myself, and he began to turn on me, I suddenly recognized the process.
But I thought you were the downfall of that relationship, I said, looking at her carefully through the steam rising from my teacup.
Nikki ran both hands into her hair, lifting it away from her head and letting it fall again, giving her head a slight toss.
Oh, no, she said. I was his revenge.
Never mind the fact that he'd been screwing around on her for years. He found out she was having an affair, so he had me.
Nice, huh? I didn't realize all this until much later, but that's how it was.
Wait a minute. Let me see if I got this straight, I said. He found out she was involved with someone, so he gets involved with you and then divorces her. From what I understand, she got reamed.
Oh, yes, that's exactly what he did. The affair with me was his way of proving he didn't care. Taking the kids and the money was her punishment. He was very vindictive. It was one reason he made such a good attorney. He identified passionately with anyone who'd been wronged. He'd whip himself into a frenzy over the least little thing, and then he'd use that as a driving force until he'd ground the opposition down. He was merciless, absolutely merciless.
Who did Gwen have the affair with?
You'd have to ask her that. I'm not sure I ever knew. It was certainly something he never talked about.
I asked her about the night Lawrence died, and she filled me in on those details.
What was he allergic to? Animal hair. Mostly dogs, but cat dander, too. For a long time he wouldn't tolerate pets in the house, but then when Colin was two, someone suggested that we get him a dog.
I understand Colin's deaf.
He was born deaf. They test newborns' hearing, so we knew right away, but nothing could be done for him. Apparently I had a mild case of German measles before I even realized I was pregnant. Fortunately, that was the only damage he seemed to suffer. We were lucky to that extent.
And the dog was for him? Like a guard dog or something?
Something like that. You can't watch a kid night and day. That's why we had the pool filled in. Bruno was a big help, too.
A German shepherd.
Yes, Nikki said, and then hesitated slightly. He's dead now. He got hit by a car right out there on the road. But he was a great dog, very smart, very loving, very protective of Colin. Anyway, Lawrence could see what it did for him, having a dog like Bruno. So he went back on the allergy medication. He really did love Colin. Whatever his faults, and he had lots of them, believe me, he did love that little boy.
Her smile faded, and her face went through an odd alteration. She was suddenly gone, disengaged. Her eyes were blank, and the look she gave me was empty of emotion.
I'm sorry, Nikki. I wish we didn't have to go into all of this.
We finished our tea and then got up. She removed the cups and saucers, tucking them into the dishwasher. When she looked back at me, her eyes were that flat gunmetal gray again.
I hope you find out who killed him. I'll never be happy until I know.
The tone of her voice made my hands numb. There was a flash in her eyes like the one I'd seen in the eyes of the geese. Malevolent, unreasoning. It was just a flicker, and it quickly disappeared.
You wouldn't try to get even, would you? I asked.
She glanced away from me.
No. I used to think about that in prison a lot, but now that I'm out, it doesn't seem that important to me. Right now, all I want is to have my son back, and I want to lie on the beach and drink Perrier and wear my own clothes, and eat in restaurants, and when I'm not doing that, I want to cook, and sleep late, and take bubble baths.
She stopped and laughed at herself, and then took a deep breath.
So, no, I don't want to risk my freedom.
Her eyes met mine, and I smiled in response.
You better hit the road, I said.
Chapter 7.
I stopped off at the Montebello Pharmacy while I was in the neighborhood. The pharmacist, whose name tag said Carol Sims, was in his 50s, medium height, with mild brown eyes behind mild tortoiseshell frames. He was in the midst of explaining to quite an old woman exactly what her medication was and how it should be taken. She was both puzzled and exasperated by the explanation, but Sims was tactful, answering her flustered inquiries with a benign goodwill. I could imagine people showing him their warts and cat bites, describing chest pains and urinary symptoms across the counter. When it was my turn, I wished I had some little ill I could tell him about. Instead, I showed him my ID.
What can I do for you?
Did you happen to work here 8 years ago when Lawrence Fife was murdered?
Well, I sure did. I own the place. Are you a friend of his?
No, I said. I've been hired to look into the whole case again. I thought this was a logical place to start.
I don't think I can be much help.
I can tell you the medication he was taking, dosage, number of refills, the doctor who prescribed it, but I can't tell you how the switch was made.
Well, I can tell you that. I just can't tell you who did it.
Most of the information Sims gave me I already knew. Lawrence was taking an antihistamine called Histadril, which he'd been on for years. He consulted an allergist about once a year, and the rest of the time the refill on the medication was automatically okayed. The only thing Sims told me that I hadn't known was that Histadril had recently been taken off the market because of possible carcinogenic side effects. In other words, if Fife had just taken the medication for a few more years, he might have gotten cancer and died anyway.
Maybe, the pharmacist said.
We stared at one another for a moment.
I don't suppose you have any idea who killed him, I said.
Nope.
Well, I guess that's that. Did you see any of the trial?
Just when I testified. I identified the pill bottle as one of ours. It had been pretty recently refilled, but Fife himself had done that, and we'd chit-chatted at the time. He'd been taking Histadril for so long we hardly needed to talk about that.
Do you remember what you did talk about?
Oh, the usual thing. I think there was a fire burning across the back side of the city about that time, and we talked about that. A lot of people with allergies were bothered by the increase in air pollution.
Was it bothering him?
It bothered everyone a little bit, but I don't remember him being any worse off than anyone else.
Well, I said, I thank you for your time. If you think of anything else, will you give me a buzz? I'm in the book.
Sure, if I think of anything, he said.
It was mid-afternoon, and I wasn't meeting Gwen again until 6 o'clock. I felt restless and out of sorts. Bit by bit, I was putting together background information, but nothing was really happening yet, and as far as I knew, nothing might ever come of it. As far as the state of California was concerned, justice had been served, and only Nicky Fife stood in contradiction of this. Nicky and the nameless, faceless killer of Lawrence Fife, who had enjoyed 8 years of immunity from prosecution, 8 years of freedom that I was now being hired to violate. At some point I was bound to tread on someone's toes, and that someone was not going to be happy with me. I decided to go spy on Marcia Threadgill. At the time she tripped on that crack in the sidewalk, she had just come from the craft shop, having purchased items necessary to make one of those wooden purses covered with assorted shells. I imagined her decoupaging orange crates, making clever hanging ornaments out of egg cartons festooned with plastic sprigs of lily of the valley. Marcia Threadgill was 26 years old, and she suffered from bad taste. The owner of the craft shop had filled me in on the project she had done, and every bit of it reminded me of my aunt. Marcia Threadgill was cheap at heart. She turned common trash into Christmas gifts. This is the mentality, in my opinion, that leads to cheating insurance companies and other sly ruses. This is the kind of person who would write to the Pepsi-Cola bottling plant claiming to have found a mouse hair in her drink, trying to net herself a free case of soda. I parked a few doors down from her apartment and got out my binoculars. I slouched, focusing on her patio, and then sat up.
"Well, I'll be damned," I breathed.
In place of the nasty brown withered fern was a hanging plant of mammoth proportions, which must have weighed 20 pounds. Now, how had she lifted that up to attach to a hook high above her head? A neighbor? Boyfriend? Had she done it herself, perchance? I could even see the price tag stuck to one side of the pot. She'd bought it at a Gateway supermarket for $29.95, which was quite a price considering that it was probably full of fruit flies. Shit, I said. Where was I when she hoisted that mama up? 20 pounds of glossy plant and moist soil on a chain at shoulder height. Had she stood on a chair? I drove straight over to the nearby Gateway supermarket and headed back to the produce department. There were 5 or 6 such plants. Dumbo ears or elephant tongues, whatever the damn things are called. I lifted one. Oh, my God, it was worse than I had thought. Awkward and heavy, impossible to manage without help. I picked up some film in the 10 items or less, no checks line, and loaded my camera. Marcia, you little sweetheart, I cooed. I'm gonna nail your ass. I drove back to her apartment and got out my binoculars again. I'd no more than settled down on my spine, glasses trained on her patio, than Miss Threadgill herself appeared, trailing one of those long plastic hoses, which must have been attached to her faucet inside. She misted and sprayed and watered and carried on, poking a finger down into the dirt, plucking a yellow leaf from another potted plant on the patio rail. A real obsessive type by the look of it, inspecting the underside of leaves for God knows what pests. I studied her face. She looked like she'd spent about $45 having a free makeup demonstration in some department store. Mocha and caramel on her eyelids, raspberry on her cheekbones, lipstick the color of chocolate. Her fingernails were long and painted the approximate shade of cherry syrup in the sort of boxed candies you wish you hadn't bitten into so eagerly. An old woman in a nylon jersey dress came out onto the patio above Marsh's, and the two had a conversation. I guessed that it was some kind of complaint because neither looked happy, and Marcia eventually flounced away. The old lady yelled something after her that looked dirty even in pantomime. I got out of the car and locked it, taking a clipboard and legal pad. Marcia's apartment was listed on the register as 2C. The apartment above hers was listed under the name Augusta White. I bypassed the elevator and took the stairs, pausing first outside Marcia's door. She was playing a Barry Manilow album full blast, and even as I listened, she cranked up the volume a notch or two. I went up another flight and tapped on Augusta's door. She was there in a flash, her face thrust forward through the crack like a Pekingese, complete with bulging eyes, pug nose, and chin whiskers. "Yes," she snapped. She was 80 years old, if a day. "I'm in the building next door," I said. "We've had some complaints about the noise, and the manager asked me to look into it. Could I talk to you?" I held up my official-looking clipboard. "Hold on." She moved away from the door and stomped back into her kitchen to get her broom. I heard her bang on the kitchen floor a few times. From below, there was a mighty thump, as though Marcia Threadgill had whacked on the ceiling with a combat boot. Augusta White stomped back, squinting at me through the crack.
"You look like a real estate agent to me," she said suspiciously.
"Well, I'm not. Honest."
"You look like one anyway, so just go on off with your papers. I know all the people next door, and you aren't one."
She slammed the door shut and shot the bolt into place. So much for that. I shrugged and made my way back down the stairs. Outside again, I made an eyeball assessment of the terraces. The patios were staggered in a pyramid effect, and I had a quick flash of myself climbing up the outside of the building like a second-story man to spy on Marcia Threadgill at close range. I had really hoped I could enlist someone's aid in getting a first-hand report of Ms. Threadgill, but I was going to have to let it slide for the moment. I took some pictures of the hanging plant from the vantage point of my car, hoping it would soon wither and perish from a bad case of root rot. I wanted to be there when she hung a new one into place. I went back to my apartment and jotted down some notes. It was 4:45, and I changed into my jogging clothes, a pair of shorts and an old cotton turtleneck. I'm really not a physical fitness advocate. I've been in shape maybe once in my life, when I qualified for the police academy. But there's something about running that satisfies a masochistic streak. It hurts, and I'm slow, but I have good shoes, and I like the smell of my own sweat. I run on the mile and a half of sidewalk that tracks the beach, and the air is usually slightly damp and very clean. Palm trees line the wide grassy area between the sidewalk and the sand, and there are always other joggers, most of them looking lots better than I. I did 2 miles and then called it quits. My calves hurt. My chest was burning. I huffed and puffed, bending from the waist, imagining all kinds of toxic wastes pumping out through my pores and lungs, a regular purge. I walked for half a block, and then I heard a car horn toot. I glanced over. Charlie Scorsone had pulled in at the curb in a pale blue 450 SL that looked very good on him. I wiped the sweat trickling down my face on an upraised shirt sleeve and crossed to his car.
"Your cheeks are bright pink," he said.
"I always look like I'm having an attack. You should see the looks I get. What are you doing down here?"
"I felt guilty, because I cut you short yesterday. Hop in."
"Oh, no," I laughed, still trying to catch my breath. "I don't want to get sweat all over your seats."
"Can I follow you back to your place?"
"Are you serious?"
"Sure," he said. "I thought I'd be especially winsome so you wouldn't put me on your possibly guilty list."
"Won't help. I'm suspicious of everyone." When I came out of the shower and stuck my head around the bathroom door, Scorsone was looking at the books stacked up on my desk.
"Did you have time to search through the drawers?" I asked.
He smiled benignly.
"They were locked."
I smiled and closed the bathroom door again, getting dressed. I noticed that I was pleased to see him, and that didn't sit well with me. I'm a real hard-ass when it comes to men. I don't often think of a 48-year-old man as cute, but that's how he struck me. He was big, and his hair had a nice curl to it, his rimless glasses making his blue eyes look almost luminous. The dimple in his chin didn't hurt either. I left the bathroom, moving toward the kitchenette in my bare feet.
"Want a beer?"
He was sitting on the couch by then, leafing through a book about auto theft.
"Very literate taste," he said. "Why don't you let me buy you a drink?"
"I have to be somewhere at 6, I said.
"Beer's fine, then."
I uncapped it and handed it to him, sitting down at the other end of the couch with my feet tucked up under me.
"You must have left the office early. I'm flattered." "I'll go back tonight. I have to go out of town for a couple of days, and I'll have to get my briefcase packed, tidy up some loose ends for Ruth."
"Why take time out for me?"
Scorsone gave me a quizzical smile with the barest hint of irritation. "God, so defensive. Why not take time out for you? If Nikki didn't kill Lawrence, I'm as interested as anyone in finding out who did it, that's all."
"You don't believe she's innocent for a minute," I said.
"I believe you believe it," he said.
I looked at him carefully. "I can't give you information. I hope you understand that. I could use any help you've got, and if you have a brainstorm, I'd love to hear it, but it can't be a two-way street."
"You want to lecture an attorney about client privilege, is that it? Jesus Christ, Milhone, give me a break."
"Okay, okay, I'm sorry," I said. I looked down at his big hands and then up at his face again. "I just didn't want my brain picked, that's all." His expression relaxed and his smile was lazy.
"You said you didn't know anything anyway," he pointed out. "So what's to pick?" "You're such a goddamn grouch."
I smiled then. "Listen, I don't know what my chances are on this thing. I don't have a feel for it yet, and it's making me nervous."
"Yeah, and you've been working on it, what, 2 days?"
"About that."
"Then give yourself a break while you're at it."
He took a sip of beer, and then with a small tap set the bottle on the coffee table.
"I wasn't very honest with you yesterday," he said.
"About what?"
"Libby Glass. I did know who she was, and I suspected that he was into some kind of relationship with her. I just didn't think it was any of your business."
"I don't see how it could make any difference at this point," I said.
"That's what I decided. And maybe it's important to your case, who knows? I think since he died, I've tended to invest him with a purity he never really had. He played around a lot. But his taste usually ran to the moneyed class, older women, those slim, elegant ones who marry aristocracy.
What was Libby like?
I don't really know. I ran into her a couple of times when she was setting up our tax account. She seemed nice enough. Young. She couldn't have been more than 25 or 26.
Did he tell you he was having an affair with her?
Oh, no, not him. I never knew him to kiss and tell.
A real gentleman, I said.
Scorsone shot me a warning look.
I'm not being facetious, I said hastily. I've heard he kept his mouth shut about the women in his life. That's all I meant.
Yeah, he did. He played everything close to his chest. That's what made him a good attorney, too. He never tipped his hand, never telegraphed. The last 6 months before he died, he was odd, though. Protective. There were times when I almost thought he wasn't well, but it wasn't physical. It was some kind of psychic pain, if you'll excuse the phrase.
You had drinks with him that night, didn't you?
We had dinner, down at the bistro. Nicky was off someplace, and we played racquetball and then had a bite to eat. He was fine, as far as I could tell.
Did he have the allergy medication with him then?
Scorsone shook his head. He wasn't much for pills anyway. Tylenol if he had a headache, but that was rare. Even Nicky admitted that he took the allergy cap after he got home. It had to be someone who had access to that.
Had Libby Glass been up here?
Not for business, as far as I know. She might have come up to see him, but he never said anything to me. Why?
I don't know. I was just thinking that somebody might have dosed them both somehow at the same time. She didn't die until 4 days later, but that's not hard to explain if the caps were self-administered.
I never heard much about her death. I don't even think it hit the papers here. He was down in Los Angeles, though, I do know that, about a week and a half before he died.
That's interesting. I'm going down there anyway. Maybe I can check that out.
He glanced at his watch. I better let you go, he said, getting up. I got up and ambled to the door with him, oddly reluctant to see him go.
How'd you lose the weight? I said.
What, this? He asked, slapping his midsection.
He leaned toward me slightly as though he meant to confide some incredible regimen of denial and self-abuse.
I gave up candy bars. I used to keep them in my desk drawer, he murmured conspiratorially. Snickers and Three Musketeers, Hershey's Kisses with the silver wrappers and the little paper wick at the top. 100 a day.
I could feel a laugh bubble up because his tone was caressing, and he sounded like he was confessing to a secret addiction to wearing pantyhose. Also because I knew if I turned my face, I'd be closer to him than I thought I could cope with at that point.
Mars bars? Baby Ruth? I said. All the time, he said.
I could almost feel the heat of his face, and I slid a look up at him sideways. He laughed at himself then, breaking the spell, and his eyes held mine only a little longer than they should.
I'll see you, he said.
We shook hands as he left. I didn't know why, maybe just an excuse to touch. Even a contact that casual made the hair stand up along my arm. My early warning system was clanging away like crazy, and I wasn't sure how to interpret it. It's the same sensation I have sometimes on the 21st floor when I open a window. A terrible attraction to the notion of tumbling out. I go a long time between men, and maybe it was time again.
Not good, I thought. Not good.
Chapter 8. When I pulled up in front of K-9 Corners at 6 o'clock, Gwen was just locking up. I rolled down my car window and leaned across the seat.
You want to go in my car?
I better follow you, she said. Do you know where the Palm Garden is? Is that all right with you?
Sure, that's fine.
She moved off toward the parking lot, and a minute later she pulled out of the driveway in a bright yellow Saab. The restaurant was only a few blocks away, and we pulled into the parking lot side by side. She had stripped off her smock and was brushing haphazardly at the lap of her skirt.
"Pardon the dog hair," she said. "Usually I head straight for a bath." The Palm Garden is located in the heart of Santa Teresa, tucked back into a shopping complex with tables outside and the requisite palms in big wooden tubs. We found a small table off to one side, and I ordered white wine while she ordered Perrier.
You don't drink?
Not much. I gave that up when I got divorced. Before that, I was knocking back a lot of scotch. How's your case?
It's hard to tell at this point, I said.
How long have you been in the dog grooming business?
Longer than I'd like, she said, and laughed.
We talked for a while about nothing in particular. I wanted to study her, hoping to figure out what she and Nicky Five had in common that both of them had ended up married to him. It was she who brought the conversation back around to the subject at hand.
So, fire away, she said.
I curtsied mentally. She was very deft, making my job much easier than I'd thought she would.
I didn't think you'd be so cooperative.
You've been talking to Charlie Scorsone, she said.
It seemed like a logical place to start, I said, with a shrug. Is he on your list?
Of people who might have killed Lawrence?
No, I don't think so.
Am I on his?
I shook my head.
That's odd, she said.
How so?
She tilted her head, her expression composed. He thinks I'm bitter. I've heard it from a lot of different sources. Small town. If you wait long enough, anyone's opinion about you will be reported back.
It sounds like you'd be entitled to a little bitterness.
I worked that through a long time ago. By the way, this is where you can reach Greg and Diane if you're interested.
She pulled an index card out of her purse with the two names, addresses, and telephone numbers.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Any advice about how they should be approached? I was serious when I said I didn't want to upset them.
No, no, they're straight shooters, both of them. If anything, you might find them a little too up front.
I understand they haven't kept in touch with Nicky.
Probably not, but that's too bad. Old business. I'd much rather see them let that go. She was very good to them.
She reached back then and pulled the scarf out of her hair, shaking her hair slightly so that it would fall loose. It was shoulder length, an interesting shade of gray that I didn't imagine had been tampered with. The contrast was nice.